Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on New FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. My guest on the show today is Chris Evans, author of a new book about legendary former Leeds manager Don Revie. The book is entitled Revie, the Biography, and I'm delighted to say that Chris is joining me on the line. Chris, thanks so much for joining me today.
How are you? How is everyone in Ireland? All right?
Not too bad. I think everyone in Ireland is looking forward to, I might be putting you in the spot a wee bit. I think everyone in Ireland is looking forward to the visit of your fellow compatriots, Wales people. I expect a great atmosphere this weekend with the Wales-Ireland game. So I think everyone in Ireland is very, very excited for that.
Well, I think one thing we can agree on, whatever you think the result is, as long as we beat the English, we should be all right.
Yeah. Well, we will leave that. We'll park that for a minute, and we'll talk to you about your excellent new book about Don Revie, one of the most legendary figures in the game, and a really, really excellent book. Can you just tell us, Chris, what prompted you to write this biography about Don Revie?
Well, I started watching football in 1985, well, when I was 9 or 10, and I always felt that Don was a mystery man. I'd never heard of Leeds United until they reached the 1987 FA Cup semi-final where they drew Coventry. And I always remember everybody in our street always supported Liverpool or Manchester United to the point there was gangs, or you either Liverpool gang or the Manchester United gang. And I remember watching that 87 semi-final of build-up. There was a montage on ITV, and there was Billy Bremner lifting the 1972 FA Cup, and there was Don Revie with the 1974 League Championship, and more than anything, there was this vision in white that was ripping apart Manchester United and Southampton, and Gordon had to take the ball off them. And over the top of that was a T-Rex track. I think it was either Get It On or 20th Century Boy, and I was a 10-year-old. I was mesmerised by this side. And then a couple of years later, they pipped Manchester United to the English League title, the last English League title before the Premiership. And I couldn't believe that these comedy figures, that I always thought comedy figures, people like Evan Hughes, who was better known than for Question Sport, Jimmy Greaves, who was better known for On the Ball on a Saturday lunchtime, went from these very comedic facades into becoming very serious and calling so much they hated Don Revie and they hated Leeds. And I noticed that every time Don was ever remembered, there'd be the prefix disgraced Don Revie, dirty Leeds. And he was a mystery man. You know, he dominated football in the 60s and 70s and then disappeared. And I generally thought the way Don Revie was treated, I thought he committed a crime. And I just wanted to know more about this guy. And he was, to me, he was absolutely fascinating. So I think it was unraveling that mystery and discovering who Don Revie really was. And I think that's what I went into. Went into the book with the mindset, that was the mindset of the book when I first started writing it, really.
And that reputation, because even to this day, people, like, when they talk about Leeds, there's always a jibe about dirty Leeds. Do you think that reputation was deserved, or do you think it was very much exaggerated? Because of course, I know during lockdown they were shown a lot of the old football games, and football back then in the era Don Revie was manager of Leeds, it was a lot tougher. The pitches were bad, so it probably was. You wouldn't be right comparing the present day with back then, because it was a lot more physical. So was that said? Dirty Leeds tag, was that a deserved one, or was it a kind of gross exaggeration?
Well, I told Johnny Giles this, who was my great idol. I asked him the same question. He said, you know, the game was completely different then. As you said, they were basically, it was a very seasonal game. The fact that in August, September, you were playing on bowling greens just after the summer, akin to a bowling green after the summer. Then the rain would come in October and become a mud bath. Then it would freeze in January, and then again by March, April, the grounds would dry out again. So it was a very aggressive game. It wasn't, the ball was a lot heavier than it is today. It was a different game as well. And I think if you look at, like Johnny said to me, you know, they were no different from anybody else. I mean, you look at any of those sides, Liverpool, for instance, Anfield Lion and Tommy Smith, Paddy Creran at Manchester United, Ron Chopper Harris at Chelsea. These were all hard men, and I think the game was played hard. And I think, you know, it was a lot more physical and a lot more of an aggressive game than it is now. I mean, the simple fact of the matter, if you want to see an example of football, at the 1966 World Cup final, the ball hardly moves, it got wet and it resembled a lump of concrete, so they couldn't pass and spray the ball out like they used to do. So I think looking through modern eyes, yeah, it was a very rough game, but in that period I don't think they were any rougher or any tougher than any other side that was there. That was the way the game was played then. That was just a simple fact of life.
And we might chat a good bit about him as a manager, because his success was incredible, but people mightn't be too familiar with Don as a player. Can you tell us how successful of a career had he? And would it be fair to say, well, strikes me reading your book, he probably didn't, like, he was capped for England, but maybe in his the clubs he was with at the time, that his career was, he probably didn't get the honours and the recognition that he deserved when he was playing.
I think in terms of England, he was, again, a different world. You know, the manager didn't select the side, but a selection committee, and that's probably why Stanley Matthews didn't win as many caps as he should have done. But I think there are very few players who have a tactical plan named after them, in the Reevey plan. I mean, Don was Footballer of the Year in 1955. He lent his name to what I described, the Reevey plan, which we would now understand as the false nine. He was the first one playing this in 55, 56. And I mean, there's a part in the book that I quote where the newspaper, that was Newcastle Telegraph, long gone now, said when he signed for London, Sunderland did everything except roll out the red carpet for the latest superstar. That superstar was Don Reevey. And I think the other big thing that people don't realise is Don, alongside Sir Kenny Dalglish, is one of the very few footballers of the year who won the league championship as a manager. So I think Don really did become a superstar as a footballer. He was one of the most famous footballers in the country. Leeds actually signed him as a replacement for their departing star, John Charles, who was off the Juventus at that point as well. So I think in terms of Don's exploits as a footballer, they completely forgot about because of the extreme success he had with Leeds. And I think, let it not be forgot, you know, you don't win Football of the Year if you can't play, and Don could play. And I think in terms of where he was, I think maybe the criticism of Don, maybe he was a bit too restless. You know, he went from Leicester to Hull, which was a sideways move. Then he went to Man City, then Sunderland. And he always seemed to be, which is strange considering that he spent 13 years at Leeds United as manager, but he seemed totally unsettled as a player. He couldn't settle anywhere and constantly moved on, looking for the next move, but always looking for something as well. And in terms of what I find striking, that he leaves Leicester for Raish Carter, and I was largely forgotten, but at the time, Raish Carter was another player who was a superstar, won the FA Cup with Sunderland and Derby County, but he went to Hull because he wanted to play under him. So he always wanted to learn. He was always a thinker about the game, a deep thinker about the game. I think that came across as a player. And what's interesting now in the annals of history, the 1956 FA Cup final, which Man City won, beating Birmingham 3-1 in the final, was remembered as the Bert Troutman final. The Bert Troutman broke his neck in that final. But the papers of the day said there was only one player on that pitch, and that was Don Reevey. It was Reevey all the way, and that became the Reevey plan. And of course, there are very few players I could think who can lend an end to a tactical plan like that. Maybe Johan Cruyff.
And of course, when he became a manager, he was able to initiate all his ideas and implement them. And what I've found fascinating was, prior to reading the book, I didn't realise how bad of a situation Leeds were prior to taking over. So it would be fair to say that when he joined Leeds as a player and ultimately took over the club as the manager, but the Leeds that he took over, they were in a sorry, sorry state when he took them over.
Well, there'd been an electrical fire in the stadium anyway. The reason they happened to sell John Charles, who was there, as I said, their superstar at the event, which was raising money to pay for the stadium. But also, I think as well, when Don took over, people forget now, because Leeds United is so well established, that's because of him, I would say. But the football as a sport was the third biggest sport in our city. You had cricket and rugby league, and they were far, far bigger attendances. So not only was he trying to lift up Leeds by the bootstraps from the second division, he was also competing with far more popular sports. And I think it's a testament to what he did, not only for the club, but for the city, that he managed to make Leeds United the centre of the universe for so many fans. I think, you know, and I think he has my credit for that as well, for what he did in creating the image of Leeds as a city in the north of England as well.
Mm. And one of the players that he would have played with and one he would have managed would have been Jack Charlton, who, as you can imagine, Chris, who is a revered figure over here, bringing Ireland to two World Cups and to a European Championship. He is an honorary Irish man. But when Don was there as a player, he didn't, at the start, he didn't have the best of relationships with Jack Charlton. That'd be fair to say.
Well, he didn't rate Jack Charlton at all as a player. He thought Jack was lazy, was disinterested, that Jack was more interested in having a pint down the pub and going to the betting shop and indulging in the field sports, all the things we know Jack Charlton, you know, love and know Jack Charlton for. And he said to him one day, he said, I'm telling you this now, Jack, if I ever become manager of this side, you'll be the first one out the door. And it's a lovely story. They announced, Harry Reynolds announced in March of 61 that Don Revie was the new manager. And the first thing Jack Charlton said, well, that's me gone then, boys. And but what Don sat down with Jack and said, look, if they actually seen something in Jack, and he said, if you screw in that Don, you'll play for England, you'll be a full international, but you've got to buckle down. And Jack buckled down, and to the extent, if you read Jack Charlton's autobiography, the person he dedicates his autobiography is to Don Revie. So you see the huge influence that Don had on Jack. And I think that could, you know, that I think that relationship that Don enjoyed with Leeds, Jack enjoyed on a far wider scale with the great people of Ireland, you know. And I think a lot of that was a lot of what you've seen with Ireland, that unique relationship that Jack had with the Irish people, came from, you know, learning from the relationship that Donna developed with the people of Leeds.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. When I was reading your book, just talking the real success of Revie, there was a real it was a real family club. There was a great atmosphere within the club. And when I was reading it, just the parallels whenever I hear people former players that were played under Jack Charlton, they talk about that. They just talk about the real family atmosphere. So it is very, very it's without doubt that Jack Charlton, because he was at Leeds so long and would have played under Don Revie, that when he became manager, he did inherit them skills and that kind of person manager. I'm thinking of a player like Paul McGrath, who had his problems, and Jack Charlton was so good to him. So there is great parallels between Jack Charlton's time and his approach to management and Don Revie's.
I would say as well, though, I think Jack learned from Don's experience in England that Don really wanted to foster that family atmosphere. But I think the rivalry between the clubs and the perception of him made that very difficult for him to do that in England. Whereas with then Jack went to Ireland and seeing what Don tried to do with England, but he realised, look, I can do this differently. That's the way to do it. That's the roadmap to do it. But I'm going to do it differently. I am going to put my arm around the likes of Paul McGrath, who was absolutely, you know, even though he had problems, he was absolutely standing in the centre of defence for the Republic of Ireland. You know, looking at people like John Aldridge, David O'Leary, these fantastic players. The you know, Paddy Bonner is another one who came through as well. And I think what Jack did, he fostered that family atmosphere within the Republic of Ireland in the team, and the fans felt it as well. That suddenly that team became their team in a way that had never been fortified before. And I think that's why Jack enjoyed that unique relationship with the Irish fans, which I don't think we've ever seen before or since in international football, you know.
Yeah, and going back to Don's time in Leeds, like, it's remarkable is the consistency. When you only have to look, anyone, if they type Leeds honours into Wikipedia, the vast majority of the honours came in that period. And it's not just he won two league titles, but they were always there or thereabouts. So that consistency, getting the team year in, year out, that was a remarkable thing that he did, that he was able to deliver season in, season out.
I think what also is amazing about that achievement, he did that with more or less the same 11 players. Mm. I mean, substitutes weren't introduced to the early 70s. That was late on in his reign as Leeds manager. So early 70s, I should say, you know. So that was late on in his reign. But also, I think the amount of times, you know, if you look at it with the modern eyes, and Don Revie had a squad of 21, they probably won a lot more than they did. They certainly should have won the double in 72. They certainly should have won the title in 71 as well. And I think what is the most frustrating things about reading the league story is that was the dominant side of the era, but Arsenal won the double. And I think that side did deserve a double or some historic sort of achievement, which they never achieved. But like Johnny Gill said, the reason why they always fell short is because they were so successful. They played more matches than anybody else. I mean, they were reaching finals all the time, FA Cup finals, always there or thereabouts, league championship. And a lot of what got them in the end was fatigue. And if you look at the modern game now with squad rotation and all this, you know, they probably would have done a lot better. But I think you've got to remember, Don did that with the same 11 players. He got as much out of them as he could.
Mm. And you mentioned the England experience. It was a bad experience for him in that he probably missed out in terms he didn't have that day-to-day involvement with the players that he had with Leeds. And ultimately he left Leeds and went over to the Middle East, and that was incredibly controversial. And he ultimately, like the FA gave him a 10-year ban from football in England, which is remarkable. You might tell us, Christopher, if you don't mind, the circumstances of him leaving the England job and getting that 10-year ban, which to me is just so draconian, which, like, it wouldn't be implemented, I'd say, in modern day. It just seems really, really way over the top.
It's quite straightforward. Don had fell foul of the chairman of the FA, a character known as Sir Harold Thompson, who was Miss Margaret Thatcher's tutor at Oxford in chemistry. Why he was running the FA, I don't know. And it was basically pure and adulterated snobbery. The fact was that Thompson looked down on everyone, looked down on Don because he was working class and a bricklayer. And they started, because of this personal clash, he started ringing round and tapping up other managers to replace him. The Cobalt family, who owned Ipswich, were asked about the availability of their manager, Bobby Robson, at the time. Don got wind of this and decided to leave. And I think the issue around what UAE is something simple. Don was dogged by the fear of poverty all his life. He came from a very impoverished background. His father was out to work, had to find sticks to put on the fire because they were so poor. And I think he was always afraid. He was always afraid of going back to poverty and impoverishing his own family. And I think the opportunity, the UAE came up, £350,000 tax free over 5 years. You know, in those days when they earned next to nothing, you know, it was a too good an opportunity to turn around down. In terms of the 10-year ban, you know, you can only say now, look at the modern eyes, that Don became a victim of what we know as cancel culture long before that phrase was coined. Mm. The simple fact is, the 10-year ban was a restraint to trade. The FA must have known they couldn't get it through UEFA because it was never imposed anywhere else besides England. So if he came over to you guys and managed Shamrock Rovers and they qualified regularly then for the European Cup, he would have been, and they drew Liverpool in the European Cup, he could have been playing in England, he could have been managing an English ground. Equally, he could have gone to Cardiff and managed weekend, because they were in the auspices of the FA of Wales, and managed every weekend in English grounds, because Cardiff playing the English Football League. Same with if he managed Celtic. The fact was, it was puerile and just and fair. And, you know, recently I've written the FA asking for an apology, because I think Don deserves that. And I think the real tragedy of the England job is those 3 years as England manager overshadow that outstanding success that we have touched on today, you know, and all the innovation that he came up with. All the things that we take for granted now, the compiling statistics, a shirt sponsorship, all-seater stadiums, you know, even down to pre-match entertainment for fans. You know, all this was mooted by Don Revie 60 years before it happened. And I've got a lot of stick recently for saying he was the greatest manager of all time. But I think in terms of impact and his effect, they're still felt today. Even going back to the Revie plan, you know, with the false nine, it's still felt today. And that is where I think, in terms of why he is the greatest, because he is the very few manager who we still feel his impact today. All his ideas have now been adopted, and I think that's reason why he is probably the best of the lot.
Yeah, and England is very interesting. England job, because you only have to. There was a great documentary years ago about Graham Taylor's tenure there, an impossible job. And it's just like, I have so much respect for Gareth Southgate now. He seems to be making such a decent fist of it. But that is just the nature of the England job. It just seems to be just a poison chalice, because everyone since Ramsey left, like, and even Ramsey kind of left and kind of was basically sacked. So it is probably one of the it is a poison chalice, that England job, isn't it?
I think Don approached it, you know, this is my view of it. I think Don approached it from the wrong angle altogether.
Mm.
I think he wanted to come off the treadmill of 60 games a season.
Mm.
I mean, because, you know, he was a very anxious, nervous guy anyway. And I think he just wanted a quiet life. And I think he's seen the England job where you've got maybe, he said himself, you know, over a four-year period, you've got 7 or 8 important matches.
Mm.
You know, the rest of them are friendlies or qualifiers, no people are really that interested in. So I think he thought, and I think he said himself as when he took the job, you know, the season started on the 17th of August. It didn't start until the 31st of October 1974 for him. So I think he thought that was an easier way of life for him, a quieter pace of life.
Mm.
I think the second point is he generally thought he was going to work with the best players in the country. And I think what he didn't understand until he got the job, the best players in England weren't necessarily English. You take the lead side, you had Guy Sprake, who was a Welshman, replaced by David Harvey, a Scotsman. You had Gordon McQueen, who was in his centre half, a Scotsman. Johnny Giles, an Irishman. The Gray brothers were Scottish. Peter Lorimer was Scottish. Famously, Billy Bremner was Scottish. So he didn't have those players to his disposal, and I think he landed in the wrong era. How would he have handled, say, he'd had Jack Charlton, Bobby Moore? Bobby Charlton's the era just before him, and then you try to name a world class player during that era and you get Kevin Keegan, and after that you're struggling. Ray Clements, Trevor Brooking maybe, but where were the truly world class players? And they weren't there. And I wonder, had he got the job, say, in 1970 with the likes of Alan Ball and Charlton, all those still there, or got the job in 1980, you know, where you've got the emergence of Brian Robson, you've got John Barnes on the way, Glenn Hoddle is there, you know, these real world-class talents. I wonder how he would have done well. And I think ultimately, he just didn't have the players.
Mm.
And I think he kept looking, and he said himself, I kept looking and looking and looking, I couldn't find anybody. And he said himself, what he should have done was taken a leaf out of Sir Alf's book and just said, these are the best 11 players, and I'm going to stick with them week in, week out. And he just didn't do that. And also, as you touched on there as well, I think he enjoyed being around the players so much.
Mm.
I think he missed the day-to-day involvement, and that was a real problem for him. I would say Don Revie learned that the great club managers don't necessarily make the great international managers. This is a completely different job. And I think you mentioned Jack Charlton earlier, and the reason why Jack was such a great international manager was he had, in the hinterland, he had things outside of football that he enjoyed. He enjoyed, you know, like I said, field sports, famously loved his fishing. You know, so he could go off for a couple of weeks and forget all about it, then go back to it. You know, which are, a lot of these top managers, the Shankleys, the Reeves, they're obsessed by it. There's nothing else in their life. And I think, you know, they need that. And because of that, they need that day-to-day involvement. And it's interesting, Shankly really became a very unhappy man in the late 70s because he wasn't involved in Liverpool anymore. And Reeves really struggles as an England manager because of that.
Well, it's a brilliant, brilliant insight into it. We could actually talk for a lot longer about Don Revie, but briefly before I let you go, have you a prediction for the weekend, Ireland up against the Wales, and even Wales, their prospects for the Six Nations? How do you think they'll get on? Because I know you're a proud Welshman.
I've got to be very careful here because my wife's got Irish roots. So
okay.
And my father was English, so I've got to be very careful what I say here. I don't upset anybody at home.
Yeah.
No, I think, I think it all depends. I mean, Wales did well last year, but I still think we're a team in transition. I think, again, Ireland are probably in the same position, but I do think it'd be a hard-fought match. I hope we come out of it, but once I would say about Ireland, I think the great thing about rugby is the togetherness of the fans. Yeah. You know, win, lose, or draw, which is very rare in rugby, of course. I think people are just in for a great weekend, and I think the rugby's always secondary, and especially with the Irish. As I always said, our Celtic brothers over the sea, and I think we have we'll have a great time, and I'm really looking forward to it. And Six Nations is always an exciting time. You know, it's just like Christmas over here in Wales.
Yeah, no, and it's brilliant as well, because there's no restrictions. We'll have a capacity crowd, so we're greatly looking forward to all the Welsh visiting us this week. Chris, thanks a million for joining us. Really cracking read. Your book, Don Reavy, the biography, it's available now. It's published by Bloomsbury. It's available any good bookshops or wherever you get your books. Really highly recommended. Chris, thanks a million for joining us, and good luck to Wales for the for the Six Nations. Maybe not against Ireland, but listen. Yeah. Listen, Chris, thanks a million for joining us on the show.
Look after yourself. Thank you so much.